Balcony's first ever year-round bourbon was an inspiration. It all had to work together. A blend of carefully selected ingredients, Texas-sized pot stills, and creative people determined to find the absolute best way to usher a new whiskey along. When you discover how it pairs with a meaningful moment, suddenly the feeling of drinking great whiskey becomes a whole lot more.
Hey everybody, welcome to this week's episode of Whiskey Neat, spirited conversations with interesting people. Oh, I am your host, Christopher Hart. Sorry about that. So this week, as you see, this is the first for me, and I hope it goes over well. We'll find out. I'm recording from my home. This week I sit down with Matt from ADHD Whiskey on YouTube with nearly 15,000 subscribers. The Bourbon Junkies, Dan joins me again to argue about things he has no idea what he's talking about. And of course, Todd Grube to support me, which is a new feeling. We discuss the idea of a neck pour. We discuss some bourbon conspiracy theories that aren't really based on anything. And so really this is just an episode meant to be cathartic for me, to kind of quell these garbage bourbon conspiracies that are based on nothing. That wasn't even the plan for the episode. We actually plan on discussing current events. For those who have been following me on social media, I wanted to also let you guys know that next week we'll be sitting down with The Mandalorian's Katee Sackhoff. Of course, you've seen her in Battlestar Galactica, you've seen her in Longmire, and now you've seen her in The Mandalorian, the Star Wars universe. I cannot wait to sit down to speak with her. So that will be filmed next week, so it'll air the week after. But stay tuned on that. Follow me on Instagram at Whiskey Pete, and of course, check out our YouTube channel at Christopher Hart. That's Christopher with a K, last name Hart. Yeah, so without further ado, check them out. Go to Bourbon Junkies on YouTube, ADHD Whiskey on YouTube. Todd can be seen outside of small elementary schools. And without further ado, cheers. Thanks so much for doing this. Matt, I've known about you for a while. I'd definitely like to get to know you a bit more, to talk about ADHD Whiskey, one of the funniest, most silliest channels out there. And of course, Todd's joining us this week in the worst backdrop virtual green screen I've ever seen. And of course, good friend Dan here without his lesser half.
Yep, fair. Well put, actually.
I'm excited to have you guys here. There's a lot of things I'd like to discuss. I try to stay in my lane. Randall Sullivan, a good buddy of mine who helped put out The Prideful Goat, he has done the top whiskeys, you know, those types of videos where these are the, and you guys obviously are really good at it and do really well with it. I really loved your top five whiskeys not to buy, Matt, in which you were comparing, I guess, almost a million views that Dan got and was like, where are my fucking views? So I try to stay in my lane. So I don't want to just talk bourbon. I'd like to, obviously, we all have opinions about things. I talk to Todd quite regularly and we align quite a bit. And of course, I get the impression because of our comedic,
enjoyment.
And Dan have the same lane of comedy and humor. I would imagine that we're probably quite politically aligned as well.
Probably.
So I thought we could talk about some current events and kind of get some of y'all's takes on it. And
First of all, I think, you know, starting off with a lie is a good start, saying that you like to stay in your lane. I mean, Chris is a habitual lane stepper. And if you follow him on social media, you'll see that he loves to delve into controversial topics.
I've learned to curb that. So, you know, it's so funny. I always joke. One of the worst features that Facebook has is the time lapse, or what's it called? It'll show me my post from 2011.
Yeah,
and just give me a chance to prevent myself from getting canceled and just delete old posts. You know, like it'll just say like I remember making a post. I was going through it earlier, and it was just cringy. You know, we grow. That was 9 years ago.
Sure.
So I don't know where you were 9 years ago, but being Facebook friends or being on Facebook 9 years ago, like at the, not quite the dawn, but the second generation of social media, was probably not good for anybody.
Right. Well, one of the things that Matt Vincent, like when we were super into powerlifting, Matt Vincent and his like idea and brand was something that I attached myself to. I liked it a lot. But one of the things he says on his podcast often is, listen, I don't want to be the guy that I wanted to hang out with. Like if I'm me 5 years ago, I don't want to hang out with me 5 years ago. Like I'm good, right? Like if I haven't changed or grown enough in the past 5 to 10 years that I still want to be buddies when I was a dumbass, like I'm good. I'm all set, you know? And I think that's a, like you, that's to your point. I completely agree. I look back on haircuts I don't want anymore, right? Like I've said way worse stuff than my hair's looked for the
most part. Like, yeah. I'm just happy.
Hey, Chris making hair jokes.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I agree with you completely. It's tough. And you know, the hardest thing nowadays, especially with social media, is you see, especially if you're in the middle at all, you see both sides just poisoning the well and you want to step in. It's kind of like at a bar. I don't know if you saw that OU football player who got his ass whooped by all 3'6" of that MMA fighter. But you want to de-escalate. You want to step in. But a lot of times in the bar scene as well as on social media, it just isn't going to end well. Like you want to say, hey, guys, everyone calm down. Like let's talk through this. This is unreasonable. This is unreasonable. And then it becomes a complete shit show. So I've learned – you know, I still get sucked into the Jack Daniels debate or some other stuff quite a bit, but
I saw you in your Facebook group stirring all the pots that you could possibly find. You're like, neck pores aren't real. Jack Daniels is bourbon. Like you're like, you were on like a tangent and I was laughing so hard reading through the comments.
Are you talking about the other day when I said that all distillate is rum because it's made from sugar?
Yep.
You know, it's funny about that. The other thing about social media that's so funny is I was just being a silly goose, right? You know, no Chris D'Elia references, but goose. I was just being a silly goose.
Right.
And I made two posts that day that were somewhat, I even said hot dogs or sandwiches and people, so a few people would message me. They were like, are you okay? I'm like, I'm fine. Like I was just being silly. Like it's just a hot take, you know, it's just,
I like it though, because I don't want to say that we bully people into agreeing with us on this stuff, but I hope that we're creating more educated people. I mean, that's 10,000 people that I've seen pour into pages like Bourboner, where I see them attacking people who are talking about neck pores. And I'm like, yeah, you know, go get them.
See, I'm a neck pore believer. So we do not align on this. All right.
Oh, really?
I'm 1,000% a neck pore supporter for the rest of my life.
Who doesn't believe in the neck pore
theory? These two don't.
These two don't. So
isn't it solved by just going like this one time?
Yeah. So you know what's okay. I had no idea that half of the people in this chat today were going to be taking this stance would be the respectful way to say that.
Yep.
So let's.
I didn't know either. I didn't know half the people in this chat I wasn't ever going to talk to again.
So let's discuss this awful thing. So have you seen my points on this, Dan?
Hold on. Before we get into that part, define what you guys call a neck pore so that we're all on the same page with the terminology.
Man, that's a good idea. That's a great, God dang it. Someone so logical and so wrong all at the same time. So the phenomenon of the neck pore is that the first pore is different, whether good or bad, than maybe the
subsequent. Usually bad, right? Usually bad.
Generally, yeah.
Then the subsequent pores, due to that being the portion of the liquid that is exposed to what air is in the bottle, and whether they want to call it oxidation or oxidization, which would be more correct, their argument is that the subsequent pores tend to be protected from the air in the bottle and better in general,
including subsequent pores immediately after the first pour. Not just talking about, you know, 3 months later
Great point, Todd. Great point, Todd, because what you're really saying there, for those who are following along, is that the subsequent pours would realistically be exposed to more air in the bottle than that first pour.
Okay. So I don't, anybody who thinks that if this was full, right, and it's here,
yeah,
I pour some out and then I drink it, I'm like, that's not very good. And then I pour more out in a second glass and I say, that's better. Those people are idiots, right? Okay. I'm on your guys' side when it comes to that. Now,
because that's their palate, right? Just to stop you for a second. My argument on this whole thing is that often if it's your first pour of anything, it's a little harsh on the tongue, especially if it's high proof. And that as your palate, you know, anytime you sit there with a glass of whiskey, I would argue that if it's in a reasonable amount of time, let's say 15, 20 minutes, that pour is, if it's changing, it's changing because your palate is adjusting. You're coating your tongue and your mouth and your taste buds. You're adjusting to it. And so that last sip is going to be a little bit different. But what the neck pour people are saying is that it's oxidization, or that there's some other factor that doesn't involve their own palate.
All right. So I could be wrong here, but Matt, tell me whether you agree or not, since, you know, we're on team, obviously, neck pour here. So in our world, in reality, where Matt and I both live, like when we open a bottle and it's, let's say the bottle's fine, right? Hypothetically. And then like 3 months later, we revisit and we're like, holy shit, it's amazing. Right? Now, I think when I think neck pour, I think just like the initial opening of the bottle might be stuffy or might need to like unpack. Sean always says unpack, whatever. That's just a word. It's like saying smooth, right? Whatever.
Sure. No, unpack makes sense. I get it.
Right. So it's kind of like, and this is where I think Matt and I both live in this topic, is it's usually down the road for us, I think, right, Matt? That the change I'm talking about is down the road.
Yeah, for sure. It's after it's just sat there for a little while. And okay, I understand. There's people who use big words and that I don't know, and that you're super smart. You guys are so smart. And there's so much science.
So hold on.
Listen, I'm not done. I will be quiet, but I am not done. Your science is bad. Your science might be scientific, but I literally was crowned the world's top whiskey taster. That in its own sense is a form of science, because scientists would have looked at this and said, there's no way that is the world's top whiskey taster. But guess what, bitch? Boom. It happens. It's weird. It does.
I am just now realizing I invited Bert Kreischer on the show today. Listen, let's talk about this. First of all, top whiskey taster. Absolutely. Like, congratulations. I think blind tests and blind tastings and those sorts of competitions, they serve a purpose. They're good things. I myself avoided for many years to do Wade's. So everyone here knows Wade Woodard, good or bad. He was doing these blind taste tests where he was awarding points if you could get the distillery and more points if you get the exact product. And they were all singular blind tests that evolved over time. The first go round, it was like, hey, there are 17 samples, do 3 of them and turn them all in on Monday. So people were doing 3 of them and on Monday. And what happens is you inherently are comparing the 3 to each other when you should just be grading the individual sample as is. So over time, these tastings filled in the gaps and corrected the issues that were fundamentally flawed. I avoided doing them because I feel like anytime you are the face of something, I mean, you're a bourbon junkie, right? Like, you guys are a big deal, far bigger than I could ever hope to be, but the idea of you getting something wrong or embarrassing yourself in a blind tasting is something that your haters or whomever might glom onto. I'm getting a little off tangent here, but let's. I avoided doing them, but the last one we did, I went ahead and just did it, and I won. I'm just saying. Sure, you got world whiskey taster. Guess who wasn't a part of that competition? You know what I mean?
In all fairness, I won the previous year. So Chris and I are coming from a place, while not as amazing as your accomplishment, hopefully not complete amateurs at this.
Right.
Oh, and by the way, I just use that as some sort of fire. That's all I got. I literally have nothing else.
So, well,
it's in the back pocket. Do I?
So let me
kind of.
Let me grab on to what Chris was saying. You know, so Wade has done a lot of non-scientific studies where we test a lot of these theories, and he tackled both the fresh pour thing, where we had maybe a dozen people in a room, and he had one set of glasses that were filled with whiskey that had been poured 30 minutes prior, one that was I think 60 minutes, and another one that he poured fresh while we weren't watching. And then we sat there, same identical whiskey, everyone got the same samples. And then all of us, who I think are, you know, fairly knowledgeable, you know, not a bunch of people who just started drinking whiskey. And we tasted through them. And in the end, basically, we couldn't tell what was what. And we were labeling things wrong. You know, like, I like this one more. And I think this is the fresh pour. And, you know, basically everyone, almost everyone was completely wrong. Now, that while not scientific, I think it just showed that we couldn't discern a difference, that there is a mental aspect to a fresh pour where you think, going into it, hey, maybe this is a neck pour and it's going to be kind of harsh.
Before we go too far down this rabbit hole, let me just go ahead and clarify our stances on everything. And then we can know where we stand on the issue specifically and then debate from there. But long-term slow effects that takes place over years, I believe in. I believe this has been proven.
Depending on the level too. Like if you just poured 3 ounces, I don't think that there's much of an effect if you've stored it properly.
Sure. Yeah. Once you get below a certain point in the bottle, like let's say it's 3/4 empty, it's a different conversation altogether. But the idea that your whiskey will go bad in 6 months or go bad in 2 years, or that you need to dip it upside down and wet the corks, and that if you let it rest for 15 minutes, it's going to change. All of those ideas are in my opinion, they're not based on anything. There is something that you are noticing that's different, but I think what's happening is a lot of people are aiming that blame at one thing versus considering other things that might be the reason you're experiencing a difference.
Sure.
So short term, I think it's not basis on it. There's no base in it at all. Long term, years and years and years, possibly. Dan, being a great lover of peated whiskey, myself included, I've got several dozen open bottles of Lafroy and backups that are unopened they've been open for years. I mean, literally since 2012, that I've done comparisons to, and it's indiscernible. Now, most of those bottles are full too. They're not, you know, 10% full, but for those that are following along and freaking out, the idea of a neck pour is a relatively new idea. This is not something that was talked about 3 years ago. The Facebook groups, nobody was saying neck pour. In fact, anyone that you would consider credible, Ralphie, the Whiskey Tribe guys, anyone that's been in the game for a long time, they're not using the term neck pour.
But is it a new term? Or because I don't think it's a new idea, is it?
So, Todd, you're so level-headed and logical. I love it. So the idea of things opening up or changing, that's not new for sure. Right. The term is new, and a lot of people are blaming that first pour in the neck as the good or bad, mostly bad. And then, of course, blaming what little bit of headspace is in the bottle. John Little from Smooth Ambler, Travis Whitmire from Whitmire's Distilling. A few distillers got involved, ran mass spec on samples that had been open a year. Even the Iron Root guys up in Denison have played around with it. They've done ABV tests because what we know happens over decades, like with dusty bottles that have low neck fills. I'm trying to think of one I've got, but you've seen the dusty bottle that's completely sealed. That's that the levels have dropped right. Quite a bit. what happens there is alcohol evaporation, and that will drop the ABV. It will change the flavor in the bottle. All of those things are acknowledged as real things.
Right.
But this idea that the first pour is the bottle's fault versus your fault isn't really based on anything. You're talking about liquid that lives in a living, breathing wooden container exposed to oxygen for sometimes decades, right? And that first, meaning the surface ratio of liquid being exposed to air is much greater, right? So it stands to reason for instance, I did a Four Roses pick a few years ago for my wife that had 72 bottles in it. It was a third full when we had picked it after 10 years. I mean,
I have a question though.
Yeah.
So you're saying that the liquid's been in a barrel for how many years, right?
Yeah.
They take them out of the barrel and they blend them together. Sure. Then they're immediately bottled.
Not always. So, sometimes they're tanked for a little while and they're
right.
Yeah.
So when you mix things together, they change, right?
Sure. Blending. Yeah.
So that liquid hasn't been sitting in a barrel.
But what about a single barrel?
A single barrel, that argument is that would be an argument. But right. a blended bourbon or a blended whiskey hasn't been that.
The components of that
chemically blend, it's the same.
Yeah, the components of that blend, each individually in their own barrels before they're all blended together, are at a much higher exposure to oxygen than once they're all blended together. It's kind of like, I don't know, have you guys seen the smoke wagon? The one that was gifted, the controversial smoke wagon bottle that's literally blacker than death and it's 70% four years old.
Yeah.
So there's some impending controversy with this. I wish I had a picture to show you guys, but actually I do. So essentially what doesn't make sense is you've got this smoke wagon bottle that is 70% 4 years old. And somebody took a picture in a glass next to a bottle that was like 8 years old. And it was so, and I've got the,
it looks like black coffee.
Yeah. And I don't see if you can see that. You see that?
Yeah, you can see it. Yeah.
See.
Yep.
Yeah. So that one on the, I guess it would be y'all's left or right.
Right.
Sure.
Yeah. Is 70% 4 years old. This bottle was gifted. It wasn't sold.
Right.
Which we think is part of the impending controversy because the smoke wagon, what Aaron has been telling people is that the filter, the sift that catches all the barrel char when you dump the barrels fell into the vat. And the barrel char that fell into the vat sat there for 4 years, just darkening the liquid. What doesn't make sense about this is that in each individual separate barrel of four-year-old whiskey, there's far more char in the barrel than what gets caught in a sift, right? So the barrel's literally lined with it. Even the stuff that comes out with the liquid when you dump it, it's still a fraction of what's actually in the barrel exposed.
Well, I guess it depends how much was in the sifter. I mean, we've all seen those sifters, no?
I'm getting there. So I think there's an explanation here. I think there's more to it. And I think we're just waiting for that information. But based off what we know, it doesn't make sense that the sifter, if you dump 18 barrels into a sifter and the sifter falls in, what a fraction of the char that was in those 18 individual barrels that had far more surface ratio exposure to liquid is far more charcoal coloring influence than the remnants that fall out of the barrels altogether. Does that make sense?
Yeah, but the difference is Aaron doesn't rotate barrels. So the whiskey in those barrels right now is only touching the same surface area of the same barrel for that amount of time, right?
Okay, but that's still a fraction. What comes True. Out of okay. the barrel through a sift, I mean, when I say a fraction, I mean less than 10%.
Right.
The barrel is literally full of barrel char.
So we just did a thing where we took a mason jar full of we dumped a fifth of mellow corn into a mason jar, right? And mellow corn is like damn near clear, right? So
use barrels.
Yeah. And so we dumped a fifth of mellow corn, which is very yellow, into a mason jar. And we put two little pieces of toasted, not even charred wood in it for I think a week and a half or 2 weeks. And it's almost the same color as Stag Junior right now.
Right. So acknowledge all that, but you're talking about taking liquid that wasn't exposed to brand new char and adding new coloring to it. When you take four-year-old whiskey that spends its life on a smaller scale,
right,
with more exposure to direct charcoal, those, if you were to, great example, here's a great example. Let's say he's got 18 barrels of four-year-old whiskey, bourbon. Sure. If you were to dump those out and set them all next to each other on a table, they would all be about the same color with some variance, right? if you were to blend them together, they wouldn't create that dark of a liquid. It would be a median average.
Yeah.
Right. So if you are only taking a small fraction of the char in the barrel and adding it to a much larger vat, it's significantly less exposure than if you just kept them separately in their own barrels.
But tell me why you're not buying the, because what's the difference?
There's more to it than that, is all I'm saying.
Okay. Well, what I'm saying, this is the first time I'm hearing this explanation, by the way. So if all that extra char fell into the barrel and then sat there, and that's the only difference between that and other barrels, isn't it the simplest answer to say, well, we don't know the science of it, of why all these like little minuscule pieces of char could have, it made it dark. I mean, I would just think, well, that's what happened.
Yeah. You know? So it just doesn't add up is what I'm saying. So if you had taken 18 barrels that have dumped through the sifter and whatever char was left, and you were to take that char and put it into one barrel, yes, it would make it darker.
I just wonder if it's still bourbon, because I mean, when you have something that happened as an accident and we assume that the sifter only had char, like, I don't know what else could have gotten into that, but it seems like a.
Also, if you talk to thing. and I talked to a few larger brands than Smoke Wagon, and it the explanation that it's now here's here I'm giving them a caveat here. So let's say that barrel filter was actually a filter from the last 1,000 barrels he dumped. That would be a different case, because then you are definitely adding a lot more char to the current liquid. But if it's the same char that the liquid was already exposed to, but on a much smaller fraction of a scale, then it doesn't make sense that it made it darker. It doesn't add up. And anyone who has any experience at all in blending, a huge red flag. And so the whole point I'm trying to make, going back to the whole neck pour thing, it doesn't, your body, there's some days I love sushi. Some days I'll smoke, it's been a while, but you know, the last time I had a poker game, I smoked 6 cigars in one evening. You are in the mood for things sometimes. Right. Sometimes fast food doesn't sound good. Sometimes sushi doesn't sound good. You're just not in the mood for it. Yeah, if you've got something going on with your gut, or if you're not feeling well, then things that can be affected the way that you taste things can be affected by that. Why are we blaming a bottle of whiskey as if somehow taking it from a barrel that's been exposed to oxygen its entire life, putting in a bottle to much, much less oxygen, literally a fraction of oxygen. And to be honest with you, most of it's not oxygen. It's actually got a layer of ethanol on top that's crammed in there. So its actual exposure to oxygen is much, much minuscule compared to the way it is inside a barrel.
But on that point, aren't we all in agreement, or Matt, are you still saying that you think that the initial opening pour is... Because I think we were talking about two different kind of definitions, right? Like the bottle that's been open for several months compared to a fresh crack.
Yeah, I'm just saying that the initial experience, the first pour out of the glass, or the first pour out of the bottle, really when the bottle has been recently opened, is when it's basically just your first experience. But the weird thing is, it's kind of like a placebo effect. It's like, even if there's no such thing as a neck pour, there's still such thing as a neck pour, because it's something that people experience. So even if it's not a real thing, the fact that you can come back to it later and it has changed, it makes it a real thing.
Okay. Yeah. So that is a very reasonable stance to take. And I don't disagree with you that we are experiencing something. The problem is, like most things in this hobby, if what you're describing isn't accurate, it can be misleading. And whenever you have new people coming up in the hobby, they can start their journey with a gross misunderstanding about what's really happening. So it's important to be accurate. And what you're experiencing is not, no one's saying that you're not experiencing something. No one can argue what you are experiencing. The problem is aiming it at something that doesn't make sense versus aiming it at something that does make sense.
But the only person it hurts is the whiskey nerds. Like, I mean, it's not hurting anyone. I mean, that's one point that I always argue against it. When I see it, I laugh.
But don't downplay that. Like anyone who's ever educated anyone, or taught a class, and let's be honest, you guys have this massive influence, this massive following, ADHD whiskey, bourbon junkies, you guys have people who listen to what you say. So whenever you say something, they're going to take from it and they're going to treat it as gospel. And so
we literally made, so we did a video on this exact topic. So because I still, after everything you just said, don't agree. So anyways, so we have, hold on. We did multiple bottles.
Is this right? The one that Wade commented on?
Is this the one I argued with Wade on?
Yeah.
Cause Wade did do a study on this over a year had people taste it.
The problem with Wade's study is that he was asking people to pick the correct one, not if there were differences or not. This is what I got into with Wade. His study was based very heavily on, can people decipher which one has been open? Not, are they different at all? Right.
Oh, is that right? I had a different understanding of it, but I'm sure you read it more recently than I did.
He blew up our comment section. He was like kind of being a dick. And then he posted his thing and he told us about his thing. So I went and read it because I'm like, listen, I'm into like hear other opinions on it. Right.
Sure.
So I go and read the whole study and I go, the problem with the whole thing that you just did was you sat people down and said, tell me which one's been open. And the problem is I don't need you to be able to decipher that one of them is the one, right? I don't need you to pick the gospel. I need you to tell me if they're different or the same. The other problem with his study was they went into it and he told everybody in the study, one of these has been open and some of them haven't. So
how is that any different than the video that y'all did? Because both of y'all stood there knowing that the Sam Houston
models. I agree with you.
So his pointing out that a trip, was it a double blind, is the more appropriate approach?
Right, the triangle, well, yeah, whatever he calls it. Yeah.
Yeah.
But the problem with how he did, because I agree with you that we knew the state of both bottles, right? The problem is we didn't bring in a bunch of random people and tell them that one of them had been open, right? If he would have brought, let's say you're going to bring in 10 people. If we bring 10 people in here and we just say, there's, let's say, 3 or 4 whiskeys in front of you, whatever it is, tell us, write down notes on each one. That's all I want. I don't care, you know, and if they all write down the same notes on them, I get it. You're 100% right. The problem is he brought people in and said, one of these has been opened, pick the one. And it's like, well, but you're not deciphering whether one has been opened or not. And if that's different, you're deciphering if those people's palates can pick up something that they have no fucking idea whether they've had or not. Right.
That's a fair point. That's a fair point.
Why can't we just, I've said this before, you know, cause every time it comes up, people are like, well, that's not a scientific study. And there's always criticism. Why can't we just design a good one and like send out samples to people?
It's been tested. It just hasn't been put into a,
because you know, scientifically, it would take like 5,000 people or something, but I would be comfortable with like, if we sent it out to 30 people,
right,
and those people all sucked, you know, and couldn't figure it out. That's enough for me.
Well, you had like a control group of people that all received all samples of a brand new bottle. Yeah, I mean, I don't disagree with you. The only thing that I'm adding to that is, you know, those distillers I mentioned, Smooth Ambler, Whitmire's, they ran mass spec on samples and saw chemically there was little difference at all.
So that's, Chris, that's a point that I've seen come up a lot. Like, you'll get like chemists, like I'm an actual chemist and I know about this. And they'll start talking about science, but you know, the science doesn't matter as much if it's not discernible to a human. And, I mean, that's something we've talked about too, that like, yeah, chemically, like maybe there's a little bit of alcohol evaporation, of course, if it's sitting out in a glass, but can you tell the difference? And it comes back to that same point.
So with the video that we did, for those who don't know, we took two batches of Sam Houston 14 that are the same batch. They're both Kentucky 02. One bottle's 53 of 528. The other one's 142 of 528. So they're the exact same blend. They're the same batch, everything. So one of these had been open for about 8 months. And it has, and honestly, it's relatively low, as you can see.
Yeah.
And this one hadn't been opened at all. So we broke the seal on this one. We opened them. We poured them. Sean poured for me. I poured for Sean. That all being said, obviously, we knew that one of them had been open, one hadn't, right? So the first thing we did in the video is...
Clarification. Was that when you guys did this testing, was that first bottle half full?
No, the first bottle was, I mean, we don't drink this very much because we have a bunch of different states. So it was probably in this range right here.
All right. So
we haven't drank it since that video. Let's put it that way.
So you weren't really testing neck pour. You were testing bottle opening.
Right. So because the idea, so the reason is because in theory, this was the neck pour, right? Because it wasn't open yet. And so what we were trying to do, what we did in the video was, before we figured out which was which, we picked which one we liked more, if we liked one more than the other. And then we tried to guess which one was open, right? The first time on the Sam Houston, I think, I picked wrong. I thought the one that was open I was incorrect. The one I picked that was open was actually the neck pour, the first pour of the new bottle, right? Now, that being said, I also said that I liked the other one more, which was what I thought the neck pour was, which happened to be the open bottle. Now, the other thing we did it with was we did it with the single barrel from Valentine in Michigan with a bottle of Mayor Pinger that was 13-year-old MGP, and one had been open for about a year, and it was about half full. The other one was a brand new bottle that had never been opened before. So that was a literal single barrel dumped into a vat bottled and all on the same day, whatever, right? And we both picked, now that's a lot higher proof. I think it was 115 or 116, and these are like 100 proof. These are 98 proof. Because we wanted to test, we wanted to know if the difference that we were experiencing was more heightened by a higher proof whiskey, right? Because of the higher proof, is there like an evaporate? So for Todd, Sean's an actual chemist at a very large chemical company. And like that's his day job at the moment, right? So we wanted to see, Sean's idea was, I think that Sam Houston's not that high of a proof. I don't think we'll experience as much of a difference, was Sean's idea. So we opened the Pingree. We had two of the same bottles, thankfully. On the Pingree, it was clear as day that one of them was not anywhere. It wasn't stuffy. It wasn't packed up. One of them, like the palate was completely flat and it was really hot. And the other one, the palate was like a flavor bomb and it wasn't hot at all. We both picked the same one that we enjoyed the most, and we both picked the same one that had been open.
Did you do that after the Sam Houston pour?
We did that after the Sam Houston, yeah.
Yeah, so part of the prevailing theory or the prevailing idea, so in science you start at zero, right? You don't assert anything until you can observe it and verify it repeatedly. The idea that it's the bottle versus your own body doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. The default would be, what we do know for a fact, what has been proven, is that your body can be, you know, some things just don't taste as good some days, food wise, your whatever's going on chemically with you. So before we take that off us and put it on the bottle itself, one of the things that is explained in this is that with your very first pour of alcohol for the day, your very first pour, your mouth is going to start salivating tremendously and setting the stage for future pours, right? That first pour can be a bit hot, but by the second and third pour, you can take bigger sips.
Speaking of pours, I've taken a couple sips, but I feel like we haven't been drinking enough.
We haven't been drinking. Yeah. So I wonder in your experiment, if you had, by taking the first couple pours through Sam Houston, that you had basically set the stage, your mouth had adjusted, and then it was even more sensitive to the Pingree experience. I'd like to see that same thing, but swapped, where you do the Pingree first and see if you guys can then nail the Sam Houston. Now, I'm not saying that that argues one thing or the other, but I think it would be interesting to see if you had.
I generally have the exact opposite. So normally, the first pour of the day is hotter for me than the third or fourth, right? Or the, even let's just say the first drink, like not even pour. So the first sip of alcohol, if I like, listen, I don't come out here and start my day with Stag Junior for, there's a good reason, right? Cause I don't feel like getting kicked right in the back of my throat immediately. I'm just not man enough. But if I come out here and start with like Old Forester 100, and then I jumped the Stag Junior, that Stag Junior doesn't feel like it's trying to beat my ass, right?
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's valid. That's a big part of this whole neck pour phenomenon, is your subsequent pours, even right after you've, you know, let's say you pour a glass, the very first glass, and it takes you, this might take me 10 to 15 minutes.
Sure, right.
Well, by the time I get to that second pour, my mouth has had a full 1 ounce beating that's had a chance to adjust to alcohol. In our heads, we like to say, oh, it's the bottle, the next pour, it's opened up because it's been open for 15 minutes. Well, no, it's, why would you think it's that versus you've now prepared your mouth
for the last 15 minutes? I always like the joke that like my first bite of pizza is different than my 100th bite of pizza as well. You know, I think if we were to do a more scientific study, trying to take everything into consideration, I would say part of that would be, let's warm up your palate. Let's drink, let's provide a sample that they can drink to just get their palate acclimated to the whiskey before we start jumping into the, you know, comparisons, you know, something that's different than what we're comparing. Because I do think that first, you're right, that first pour is hot and it's a little shocking.
They do this with wine, though, right? This is a thing in wine. It's been a thing in wine for a very long time.
But do you know why?
Why?
Because there are no neck pores.
Well, no. In wine, there's still yeast and microorganisms fully active within the bottle happening the whole time. It's not the same with distillate.
Right, because it does age in the bottle, doesn't it? Wine does.
Right, right. Okay. And same with beer. Same with beer. Sure. There's active, you know. So I my only issue with all this is I feel like neck pour is it's bad because it implies something that hasn't been proven and is misleading, and anything misleading in this hobby is something that I kind of jump on. You know, you get one half of the impassioned arguers who argue that charcoal mellowing removes Jack Daniel's ability to be bourbon, but then you have the other end of the spectrum with people who loved Angel's Envy and finished bourbons and think that those aren't disqualified as bourbon.
Right.
Like how can you argue that charcoal mellowing removes the ability for it to be bourbon because it's an additive, but not argue that wine barrels and
that's ridiculous.
That 100%, all that shows is how damn good Jack Daniel's marketing is and how much money they spent. That's all it shows.
100%.
Because Jack Daniel's has literally gone on record saying that process makes them Tennessee whiskey, and that this is their brand, and their brand isn't bourbon, it's Tennessee whiskey. And so all they've done is push Tennessee whiskey in Lincoln County so hard that people go, I don't even know what Lincoln County means. It doesn't matter. It's not bourbon. That's
the master distiller has gone on record. The old master distiller went on Bourbon Pursuit and said it's still bourbon, and has done another podcast that circulates that said it's bourbon. And the current master distiller was on my show and said it's bourbon. But it doesn't matter because their website says it's bourbon. Yeah.
Well, and I know Chris knows this. I don't know if you guys know this, but Richard Seal of Foursquare Rum went on record to say that they use almost exclusively bourbon.
Their label. Exclusively ex-bourbon barrels, and they all come from Jack Daniel's.
Yeah, and there's but they're sold from Jack Daniel's as ex-bourbon.
Yeah. So
they put ex-bourbon on there. I have some Foursquare over there, the 2007 specifically, and it says bourbon on the front label.
Yeah. So the Jack Daniel's, when they're done with their barrels, will market them out to rum companies all over the world and say, "Do you guys want these barrels? They're ex-bourbon."
Right.
It's the whole thing is laughable.
That's the end of the argument for me, because of course you can't call them somebody that works for them now. That's their marketing. They're not going to say that they're Tennessee whiskey. That's their line. They're not going to ever admit it, but it is. All these other things, I think, prove it.
Does Jack Daniel's charcoal mellow after it's barreled, it's aged, or before?
Great question. So here's the thing. The regulations don't address that. In fact, the one thing the regulations do say about filtering is all post-distillation. So let's say I distill bourbon. I put it in a barrel. It's not bourbon until it hits the barrel anyways, right? That's the whole rule. But in the regulations, the class type determination is not done until the time tax is collected, which is when it's dumped and bottled. So even though we know it's meant to be bourbon and they're planning on it bottling it as bourbon, it's actually legally not bourbon until it's been bottled, till it leaves the barrel, right? So the regulations do not address whether you should charcoal filter before barreling or after. However, it does say that you can do things to liquid to change its class type. You know, for instance, it could be bourbon, and then you add maple flavoring, and now you've got Knob Creek maple. It has now changed its class type. It's no longer bourbon. Now it's something else. There's a CFR, and if anyone wants to know, I can post it in the comments. The CFR says that if you filter straight bourbon whiskey and remove more than 15% of coloring, esters, fats, or change the flavor significantly, I think it's 15% of the fats and all the stuff in it, then it can change its class type, which happens in rum, where they will remove the color in rum, where they filter it so heavily that it becomes a white rum. But that if you taste Jack Daniel's before it goes through the charcoal filtration, that banana note's still there. I think people assume that the charcoal gives it the banana note flavor, but no, it's already in the distillate before it goes through it. So
Old Forester has banana all over it too. Mm-hmm. A lot of their products do. And it's just Brown-Forman has that for sure in their profile, obviously. So
we know for a fact that there's a lot of Kentucky distilleries who do charcoal filtration after barreling, right? right? Heaven Hill does it. There's a lot of them that will do charcoal filtration after barreling. Jack Daniel's does it before barreling. If anything, you can make a stronger argument that the charcoal filtration that a lot of Kentucky bourbons go through are more disqualified than Jack is, because those, by the time they're dumped and bottled, that's when that filtration happens. Yeah. And if they remove enough of those fatty acids and esters and all those things, then you could argue that most Kentucky bourbon, if it were to hit that, but then you'd have to prove it, right? So the whole thing is really interesting. I'm not arguing whether or not your body goes through or experiences a difference. I think we just tend to blame the bottle. Like, why are we blaming the bottle? Like your mood, your palate, and it's just something that literally,
Become a part of the lexicon. I think it's just, a neck pour. Like, it's just become a thing for the same reason that people say, don't go swimming after you eat because it gives you cramps. You just start to accept it. And as someone pointed out, like, the mind is powerful. Like, it can create these things. It can make you feel a certain way.
Anyone who's worked at any Kentucky distillery, has been in this game for a decade, even just a decade, which is not that long comparatively. Jimmy Russell, Eddie Russell, those guys have been doing it for, 30 to 50 years. None of them have buy into this shit. And none of them are blaming the first pour in the bottle. No one's using neck pour that hasn't been in this hobby for less than 3 years. It's a newer thing. And I get what they're trying to explain, but they're doing it in a way that gives a bad implication of something that isn't been proven, is all I'm saying.
Because you're very interested in the sexy word specifically, neck pour, right? So yeah. The idea, I just want to back off that term just for a sec. Okay. The idea that whiskey changes over time in a bottle, I'm not saying ages, I'm saying it tastes different, that taste changes, right?
Yeah.
So if you put whiskey in a glass, in a Glen, whatever, and you fill like 3 ounces, whatever it is, right? And then you leave it out, for 3 days or 4 days or whatever, it gets milky, right?
Yep. Horrible. Yep.
We've all done it, right?
Yep.
Open
air evaporation at an accelerated rate.
Exactly. So
this has been brought up before, and it's like microwaving your meal versus slow roasting it over a fire. Yes, those changes happen. I've acknowledged that early on in this conversation. Sure. But an open air bottle, once you seal this, the thick, there's a, like, this is a half, a little less than half bottle of single malt scotch. If you can see that, I don't know if you can see it, but it's about half. There is a thick layer of ethanol vapor that sits on top of the liquid itself, kind of a condom between the open air and the bottle.
Sure.
So the sealed process is so much more slower than just simply leaving a glass out overnight.
Sure. I completely agree with you. Now, here's the thing. The problem is you guys were just saying that. Now, I think you guys did limit the time to 30, 60 minutes of it not
changing. A reasonable amount of time, because I think over hours, it gets gross. It does. Okay. I mean, if you leave it overnight, gross. But yeah, I think it goes back to there is a time limit. I don't know how quickly it happens, but I think for a normal pour, I don't think it's discernible, at least in my experience.
This pour is 124 proof. I worked overnight last night. I'm in the turn in my 2 weeks. I'm in the last phase of getting out of the day job thing. This has been sitting on this table for the past 12 hours. And it's fantastic.
Yeah.
124 proof. It's still nice and clear and hot. And, and I have not a hydrometer, but I forget the name of the tool to measure. Yeah. A little proof thing that kind of measures it. It's about the same, which the Whiskey Tribe guys did that. They did something happens around hour 40 that really shows,
Now they were picking out flavor differences far before that.
Yeah, yeah, but still less than 30-something hours. I think it was 31 hours or something.
I thought they picked up a flavor difference at 6 hours. I could be wrong.
But yeah, I'm going off memory. I'm going off memory.
Okay. I guess my point there is also, hey, everybody got a cheers because you're doing the thing. You put in the 2 weeks, you're doing the thing.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So cheers to you, buddy. Thanks, man. Congratulations, man. That's amazing.
Appreciate
it. So cool. Now,
yeah, I,
on that note of you doing something cool, you're fucking wrong. So what I wanted to say was, but like, I guess my point is like, we can show that it happens at all. I'll just say it all over time. I'm not saying how much time, and I'm not saying first pour, last, whatever, but it does have, things change because of air and whiskey, right? Yeah. Over time in a Glen, in a glass. So I feel like showing it now, it is way more air and right. It is open. It's not sealed, obviously.
And you can test it. You can scientifically test it. Sure. You can run mass spec. You can literally physically, chemically see a difference.
Okay.
But that if you do those same tests on a closed bottle that's been open for 2-3 years, zero difference, right? So something happens between it being a closed container, an open container. I made this comparison once, and I really got, I don't think I told you about it, Todd, but I think you were there for it. I made the comparison to abortion, and someone got so mad that they made some very ugly comments on my YouTube channel.
You do like to bring stuff up like that where I'm like, oh man, I'm already on this. I guess I can't escape.
Yeah. So what I was not making the comparison to abortion. I'm not saying what my beliefs are. What I'm saying is that there are some Christians or Catholics who believe that life begins at conception. Some believe it happens in the first trimester. Some believe it happens somewhere along the way, right? Actually, growing up, I knew this family where the father and mother had 6 girls, and they only procreated to have kids. There was no recreational fund, right?
Rough.
And they were teaching their daughters that, because all they had were 6 daughters, right? So they're like, don't do this. It's not fun. It's bad.
Oh, that's
so
rough.
My comparison is that I don't, as a man without a uterus, I don't know where life begins. It could be at conception. It could be at the first trimester. I don't know where the line is. It's a tough line. I know that at some point that person's, some people say when the heartbeat happens, right? Like, sure. I don't know where the line is.
But I can't wait to see where this connects back. keep going.
Yeah. So what I, you know,
this sounds like a Norm MacDonald joke or something.
Yeah, before more YouTube comments, here we go.
Yeah. Well, I took this opportunity to explain it more while it's apropos to the point at hand, so that if that person is still watching my channel, they understand that I'm not making the comparison to dead babies. What I'm saying is that I know that there's a line somewhere, but I think oftentimes we as humans aren't comfortable saying we don't know where that line is. I don't know if it's at the, you know, 10-hour mark of being in open air. I don't know if it's at a year or early on, the Whiskey Tribe guys said 6 months, your bottle will go bad in 6 months if opened. And that just simply
isn't at any true. Fill level.
Yeah. So
all these things we've talked about, they're all different factors. Like a bottle that's half or more full, I feel like it's going to change more.
Right. But I don't know where the line is. I don't know if it's exactly half full or if it's 10% left from the bottle. I think we should, you can make conclusions based off the information you have, but also say, I'm not exactly sure where this exact thing happens.
Yeah.
Right.
And he also doesn't know when life begins, if that made sense of the whole thing.
Just for people in the comments, he has no idea when a baby is a baby. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I gotta think of another comparison to use.
Yeah, I think so.
Thing. It's just
the comparison makes sense because it's something that people believe believe in very different places, right? On both sides of the thing. So I understand the analogy that you're making. And I also understand why somebody roasted your ass in the YouTube comments. So.
you know that Bert Kreischer joke where he has like a Lyle, like hear him out, hear him out. Yeah. That's basically what this is. Like I needed the support, Dan, and I appreciate it.
Why can't we just do a blind? I mean, it's and answer it once and for all and listen to everyone's feedback about all the factors we need to consider and just do it.
Okay, so how would we do it, right? So I know we were going to cover so many topics and we've pretty much only spent time on neck pour, but let's say we have an objective third party who doesn't have a YouTube channel, bottle 5 bottles of the same exact liquid and ship it out to all of us. Matt, Dan and Sean, Todd, maybe send it over to the Bourbon Pursuit guys, maybe send it over to Matt Raywald. You've got 5 bottles. You don't know if there's they're all five the same. You don't know if one's been open 6 months. You don't know if one's been open a year. And then have people, have each of us write our, I mean, I think that would be the most objective, double blind. And one of us gets a sample of all five that's been open the entire time. One of us gets a sample that's all five that's not been open, fresh neck pours. I think we could do it. And kind of put this to bed.
I would mix it up too and have like half full bottles that have been sitting out for 6 months, you know, spend some time.
I mean, that's what I said, but it's okay if you weren't listening.
But I thought your entire argument was that it's science. Like that all the science points to the fact that it literally cannot be a thing.
No.
So you being open to the idea.
It's perception.
It's the opposite. My assertion is that there's no science that says it is a thing. And until there's science that backs it up, it's not a thing, right? That's how science works. Officially, you start at zero. So until you can objectively prove, and no one's been able to do it, everyone's, a few people have tried and a few people have done it wrong, Dan and Sean, and a few people, you know, so until it's been proven, the community as a whole, by and large, is using a term aimed at blaming something that hasn't been supported by anything. So that's where I take issue with it.
But the problem, so here's the thing. I think that it's such a shit show of an idea to try to, okay, now let's just pretend hypothetically, we're going to find 10 strangers with palates we trust, send them, get them samples somehow, and not have them have any idea what the hell's going on. And not only that, we waited 7 months with a bottle half empty for it to maybe change or not change, right? Whichever one. So like the amount of time that it would take to run this, you're talking a year to do this. And then you're talking.
I think we could do it with bottles we already have open.
No, because you can't, you'd have to, because they need to be identical batches, barrels, everything, right?
Right. So if you just give you an example, I am not a poor person. Sure. So I have great example. I don't know if you ever heard of this brand or not, but I've got, you know, open bottles of this at various levels.
Okay. You know what?
Unopened bottles.
Did you just pull out your own whiskey to flex on the whole thing? You just go, you know what? Listen, I got a bunch of this stock in something that I sold the shit out of because it's fantastic.
Not only did he flex on, he also just belittled the below the poverty line. And I'm so sorry that I, on the other hand, do not own any sort of goat, let alone a prideful one.
I apologize because most of us have like bottles of whiskey behind us, and you've just got a plant. So
I see that Bardstown back there.
He's also got an empty decanter back there too. So I think we could do it with let's look through our collections. Let's find some bottles that are open. Maybe Matt has one. And then a backup unopened one from the same batch. Some of us have some bunkers that have some open and unopened. And all we would really need, if all of us contributed an unopened and an open bottle of the same batch, which we might be able to put together some samples, you know, and then send them out to each other, we should be able to all objectively not know the brand, not know if both of them are unopened or opened. I mean, we should be able to objectively contribute to the collective and come up with a pretty broad thing that, you know, based off what we currently have in stock.
See, I would be okay with doing it fully. Like we've had this conversation, let's agree on how it's going to be done and then wait 6 months and then just forget about it. And then there are the bottles have been sitting at various levels of open. And, you know, one of the things that Wade did that I thought was valid with his bottles is he would open them and pour. Every couple of weeks, just to kind of duplicate what a normal bottle would go through rather than just dumping half of it and leaving it sit. We could even pick a person, buy the bottles, give it to them and tell them what to do. And then, you know, 6 months later, samples are sent out.
So
it sounds like a lot, but I don't want anyone to be able to attack it, you know.
You're taking a bottle and pouring it into sample bottles. So what's the protocol for the sample bottles? How do they have to be cleaned?
That's actually fair.
So I mean, you're putting it into a different receptacle. That's just another question.
I actually have an answer for this, and I think this was a Berliner comment that I made that I extract the neck
under your account or your burner account.
I don't remember. that I for every bottle that I open, I pour off that first ounce into a sample bottle, because so I remove the neck pour. But then there's an actual, as you pointed out, there's a neck pour in the sample bottle. I mean, there's a little bit of air on the top, so I use an eyedropper to pull out just like a few drops off the top.
Also, great idea.
Solves the problem.
I would literally recommend that to all beginners in whiskey. Anybody listening to this that is just getting into whiskey, just listen to the man. Pour out the first down, neck, eye dropped a little bit left. You know what I mean?
So the decanter behind you, you should just fill it only full of, it's a neck, a neck pour infinity bottle where the only thing that goes into that decanter is just the very first pour of all the whiskey.
Okay. So I want to just clarify really quickly, and we can move on if you want after this, because it's not a long question. You two have never, I want to phrase it correctly. So every time that you two have had a whiskey initially, like during an opening of a bottle, and then revisited that whiskey later, every time that you've revisited it and thought it was better, you thought, I must have eaten something differently. Like, it's a different day, right?
I'll put it, let me, that's a great question. And the answer either means that my palate is shit. Okay. Or, that's probably what some people are going to right off the bat say, but then sure. I try to remind them that I want a blind taste test. So I have never had that thought. I have open bottles. I've had open bottles. I've had open for years. And I always just know that first pour is going to be a bit more hot. One of the great things that you said.
Right. Exactly.
Of anything.
That's exactly what we're saying.
No. Right, the first is hot regardless of how long the bottle's been open or if it's correct. A fresh crack or anything.
Right.
Oh,
that's what you're saying. Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. What I'm saying is my first initial pour that day right. is going to yes. be hot pour. Okay.
Yep.
And uh-huh. so I never once have thought to myself, oh my God, you know, this just doesn't seem right today. What I have thought is I'm not in the mood for scotch.
I'm on a slightly different angle here for me. And I will say that, yes, I've experienced that. But, going back to like the blind competition where I learned a lot about my palate, because I was drinking stuff every day, like multiple things. And what I would do was each of those samples, I would pour them around the same time of day, hopefully away from food that I've eaten, so not within a couple hours of a meal and so on. And over the course of 3 days, each sample, and I would spend, some time with it. And I did notice that the first day I was often, I had no idea. And then the next day, I start to figure out, okay, maybe what distiller this is. But each day it tasted different to me, and that's just day to day. Then I started doing that with other bourbons, and I've had days where I poured some of my favorite bottles where I've just thought, no, not today. It's not. I disqualify the aging thing in the bottle unless it's really low. Mainly because I know that my palate changes day to day. So like 6 months from now, if I drink something and it tastes great, my feeling is, well, it just tastes good today. Not necessarily. I don't know if it's correct or not, to be honest, the aging part.
That's why the reason I was asked, no, I don't think, I'm not saying, I don't believe the whiskey ages in the bottle.
I didn't mean aging. I know what you mean.
Right.
I misspoke.
The reason I ask is because, I think that most people have whiskey and then have the same whiskey later and think differently of it, no matter what the case being, whether they had food right before, they had steak before it, they had Mexican, they had barbecue, whatever it happens to be, right? Because that'd change up. But the reason that we visited the topic at all, other than to make content, was because we had a bottle of Stagg Jr., batch 13. And we opened it and we reviewed it. We opened it on the video. We reviewed it and we're like, man, we are humongous fans of Stagg Jr. 13. Now that means our expectations are pretty high, right? There's already a bias towards we think we're going to like, and we didn't love it. And so then we're kind of let down. So, but what it did was it went into like, at the end of the year, we do blinds almost every week, right? Somewhere on the channel in some way, shape or form.
You guys ever eat dinner before you do a video? You guys?
No, because we normally shoot in the middle of the day. We don't normally shoot after at nighttime. So, normally,
sorry, let me rephrase my question. Do you guys ever have lunch before shoot a video?
Not usually, not generally. Usually, because I intermittent fast and drink coffee and water in the morning. I don't.
Okay, listen, Joe Rogan.
This is, you gotta understand. Sean is so malnourished. We got to fit food in whenever we can, right? We were doing our advent calendar blinds where he got his ass handed to him by me personally almost every day of the advent because we made a competition of it. He was over here eating a Taco Bell quesadilla before one of the days, right? So, but one of the things that we did was at the end of the year, we put that batch 13 Say Junior in, which is about 4 or 5 months later, right? We hadn't revisited it since then. It was like, if it was in the bottle, it would have been like here from like giving people samples and stuff. That bottle in blinds did really well. And then, but we had drank it and we were like, why does it not taste so stuffed up? It tastes like there's more flavor. Like I'm dissecting more things, right? And sure. Now it had been 6 months.
And I wonder if it's the proof, like as you said earlier, I wonder if something, you know, that there's something chemically different in a higher proof that it really does lose the more alcohol.
I don't.
Go ahead. So to be clear, I will repeatedly acknowledge that you are experiencing something, but I think it's misleading to assert it's one thing when I'll give you a great example. So our second year of the Whiskey Social, which is a big festival I throw here in Houston, our second year, we also did a fall dinner, and the place that we did it at did these little sushi bites that had a tremendous amount of spice on them.
Right.
And nothing will ruin a whiskey faster than you eating spicy foods before tasting it. Right. So that's going back to what you said before, we know something happens.
Right.
We can measure it at some point. There's just so many things that, you know, just don't, can affect going into it. There, going back to what Todd's on the blind you were talking about, when I was doing those blinds, I wasn't doing them I wasn't tasting one sample over 3 days. What I would do is I would start early in the morning, taste it, but not swallow. Just leave it in my mouth, really chew on it, really process it, spit it out.
Quitter.
And what's that?
Quitter.
Quitter. And then I would come back to that same sample bottle 30 minutes later and really trying to figure out, where is this distillate from? Is it Beam? Sure. Is it, you know, whatever the case might be. So I'd do the same thing. I'd come back to it, but I wanted to make sure that my mouth was processing it and not just overwhelmed. Sure. So I do think something's happening, and I think it's a bit foolish to, especially in this hobby, when I'm only seeing one group of people saying something. But anyone with any kind of credible knowledge or education on the subject I've taken my WSET and I'm working on my certified spirit specialist and all these different things, and talking to master distillers, no one's using this term. No one's blaming a bottle, calling it a neck pour, even explaining the first pour in a bottle. But
it is it's something that's experienced on a mass scale, and it's valid. People are thinking it. Yeah, again, the question is why. There's lots of factors.
I'm not trying. I'm not saying that people aren't experiencing something. But
listen, you keep saying that nobody's experienced it in the past 3 years, but I just showed up and I'm the savant, right? So how this works is the whiskey savant and the world's top whiskey taster over here, the 1-2, right?
Getting all flush.
We're finding things nobody's found before. Like, just jump on the bandwagon. Don't fight it. You know what I mean?
Listen, man, right, thanks so much for doing the show. I have to go to the bathroom. I had to pee so bad. Right. I'm dying. Yeah. So we'll chat soon.
Yeah. Thanks for having me on, buddy.
All right. See you guys. Talk to you later.
Balcony's first ever year-round bourbon was an inspiration. It all had to work together. A blend of carefully selected ingredients, Texas-sized pot stills, and creative people determined to find the absolute best way to usher a new whiskey along. When you discover how it pairs with a meaningful moment, suddenly the feeling of drinking great whiskey becomes a whole lot more.